This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 81, brought to you in association with Synchron, Archover, and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Guy Willans, COO of Trade River, to discuss trade finance. Trade finance is one of those less media highlighted but vital areas of the financial services industry. It really is the oil in the engine of international trade. It's also one of those how hard can it be areas where actually in practice it turns out to be rather harder than you might think. One can presume that this is due to it being an extremely ancient business. After all, finance was required for the Silk Road and all other routes, and merchant banking had its origins in international trade. I think trade finance people don't get at much, because I've never come across a link-baity five ways to make trade finance flow, though no doubt that kind of trade finance porn exists in abundance. So it's a grown-up topic, and we have a grown-up today. Guy's background ranges from Sandhurst, two business schools, I wonder what the first didn't teach, and HSBC, as well as a bunch of volunteer activities. He's worked globally in the USA, Middle East, Australasia, and EU. So, once again, my team of researchers have found me a guest who manages to get a lot done. I really must book some more therapy sessions before my ego deflates even more. Trade River started trading in 2011 and have provided over £100 million of working capital finance to businesses in the UK. They provide businesses with an unsecured line of revolving trade finance to fund purchases of goods or services within 24 hours, both worldwide and in the UK. Facilities can range from £100,000 up to £5 million. They recently opened an office in Baltimore to serve the US market. In less prosaic terms, trade finance deliver working capital, and being a digital player, let's not use the fintech word, their claim is to be quick, simple, and paperless. So without further ado, let's dive into trade finance in an age of disruption. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Guy. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
So we were talking briefly before about helping kids, which is something that you're doing rather more than I do, and something I'm doing for an hour and a half tomorrow morning. So it's much on my mind. So how do you help them other than drive your own around to school and be general sort of dad taxi?
Well, I've got three, so I feel as if I've got my own army, really. But I quite enjoy rugby and actually enjoy giving a bit of time back to helping kids. I mean, I did under sixes the year that's just finished, and under sevens next year, taking my son forward and the other 40-odd kids with him.
Ah, excellent. I was always quite like football in terms of playing it, but I was at a school that did rugby, unfortunately. I never particularly liked rugby as such. But in terms of rugby, what age do they start sort of having scrums at? Because I think they don't have scrums for younger kids because there's all this problem of injuries.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they progress them through. I mean, you know, where we are sort of under sixes, it's really just playing tags, and then they're progressing through tags, and then they get on at about, I think contact starts at about year 9, 10, moving on there. So probably at the age of 9, 10, they start training up and they get progressively more contact as they go.
And in terms of teaching people of a very different age from you, how do you kind of approach that? Because we'll talk about the fascinating topic of trade finance in a minute, but the average person in trade finance is sort of slightly older than 6 or 7. In terms of communicating with people, you somehow have to sort of think in their language, as it were. How does that work?
You're absolutely right.
Or do you just tell them what to do in a military-like fashion?
No, well, sometimes that works, but quite often it's humour, having fun, just engaging them, and actually just getting onto their level, just getting them to have fun, because they really are keen to do something, to learn and to get out. Not totally in line with, as you say, all the trade finance guys who generally tend to be quite a lot older. Grey hair or no hair is probably a good motto for trade finance guys.
Yes, I quite approve of the grey hair or no hair brigade myself. Well, I'm doing this talk to a school where my older daughter finished, and I rashly said I'd do a talk for them on how the world of work has changed, which it has quite a lot since I was having long hair, actually, more than no hair. 40 years ago, I think it was, when I was their age. So I've been spending about half the weekend thinking about how to put it over to them, and
Unfortunately, although my brain can do sort of creative mode, it tends to do it by thinking about it when it's sleeping and waking me up at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning with, oh yes, I could do a slide on this. And just to try and show by example, it's about 45-minute talk and 15 minutes Q&A. One of the things I'm trying to show is that in the digital world, creativity is actually quite a good thing. So I'm starting with a PowerPoint slide, something along the lines of, you know, use one slide every 5 or 10 minutes or something, on the basis of which I should have 4.5 slides or 9 slides or something like that. Whereas actually I've got 110.
I was about to say, you've probably got a lot more.
Which is one thing you're not supposed to do. So, of course, I'm teaching them to break rules by doing that. And also, actually, it means that I can be extremely lazy now, because having got 110 slides together, I know that all I have to do is press the button every 30 seconds. And I can always waffle for 30 seconds about any given picture. And, you know, in terms of sort of communicating or trying to get them out of their frame of mind, I think the thing that's sort of been most challenging for me, which probably won't be for your kids, because they, at that age, they still like running around and pushing and shoving, yep, and grabbing balls and all that kind of stuff, is that by the time those kids that you're training are 10 years older, they have been, no pun intended given your background, somewhat regimented into following orders, sitting down and shutting up and doing as they're told. And so, you know, it can be much less creative, which is going to be sort of quite tricky for them when they actually get into the real world. So a couple of things that I'm talking about in particular are the relevance of surfing as a metaphor for the world. You know, they won't be working for 5 years' time, and what the world's going to be like then, we don't know. And the other one, actually, which is highly pertinent and again provocative just to sort of get them interested, is I show a picture of some hunter-gatherers with bows and arrows and a loincloth. I'm going to show this one up front and say, and one of the things I'm going to talk to you today is why these kids are far better educated than you are.
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, I think there are an awful lot of kids who, as you say, have had the innovation moved out of them. But actually, what I always find wherever I go, whatever jobs I do, I always get the most excitement for the first 6 months, 9 months, before we get drummed down by everybody else. And that's where most of the innovation comes. And even the guys in the company, the guys who come in new, have got the innovation and the ability to get up and go. And I think that's a really important thing.
Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting because, I mean, I think I'm sort of slightly a slower learner than you, perhaps. But in the past, when I've done various gigs, I've always come in, try to work out what's going on, and then try to think about how to do it differently. And once that's kind of been implemented, actually, I kind of then sort of lose interest once it's a sausage machine. You know, hopefully a better sausage machine than it was when I turned up.
Yep.
But I'm not so interested in turning the handle. So trying to think in a different way and trying to create stuff is particularly interesting. And I remember some kid I was speaking to once, well, kid, actually, he was in his 20s. And actually, he did actually work for HSBC, going back to sort of places that we were both worked at. This guy, I would say, was actually pretty good at doing exams and anything was such like an exam. So you put a task in front of him,
yep,
he would do it quite effectively. But what he totally lacked, which caused quite a few career problems, was it's almost like the hunter-gatherer skills have been totally beaten out of him or lost. And it doesn't matter whether you're in trade finance or whether you're trying to get a job, then your ability to sort of hunt and gather and find stuff and create stuff is actually really important, actually.
Absolutely, totally agree. And I think there's a skill that, as you alluded to earlier, is if we're not careful, gets lost by regimenting people. And I think it's very important to employ those people who actually show that spark. And that's what I look for. I look for people who've got the get up and go and the ability to add in all sorts of dimensions.
And bend the rules. And
absolutely. You know, I spent 12 years in HSBC, only 12 years, and I was always fighting the system.
Yes. Well, it's interesting you mentioned the system because, I mean, actually, we must talk about trade finance, but my brain's on auto, you think, on this one. I give a little bit of a sort of background to how it's all been organised, starting with prehistoric fish, who didn't have a job, of course. And then when we came out of the ocean, which was probably a mistake. And then when we came out of the trees. And then hunter-gathering societies were actually very stable for 10,000, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years. So they evolved in an equilibrium. They were very sustainable. And then, of course, we had agriculture, and then what I call factorization. So we had factorization of agriculture, factorization of manufacturing, and then more latterly, coming back to HSBCs or Citigroups or the vast banks that exist, factorization of the service sector. And that's why it's so interesting, actually, doing this job that I'm doing at the moment and meeting all sorts of people such as yourself, is that very, very different thing from working as part of a factorized society or a highly regulated society like FS, where there's millions of rules, to then going, OK, let's do it all differently.
Yeah, but I think let's do it all differently is always challenging, always good, and should always occur. And I think, you know, if the situation is right, which it has been for a lot of alternative finance or financial technology providers, to have a go and disrupt the market, then go for it. And I think that situation has occurred, still is occurring. And I think there's a momentum and a push, which is really giving the green light.
Yeah, so Moving on to your career and how you came to be trade financing today. As I mentioned, you had a background in the army, in HSBCs, and now this. So over your career, how did you find yourself the experience of, well, let's say, systematization, you know, systems, and you've got to follow the system. But at the same time, the people who tend to do well in the system are those who can follow the system, but actually can see where to tweak it as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think I went to a fairly regimented school, which sort of probably got me into the system mentality, but I always sort of rebelled a little bit against it, which I think is quite important. I went into the army, again, challenging environment, but one where actually, if you've got some real opportunities, you can take the capabilities of a large organisation and that and use them really effectively. I mean, I ended up doing recruitment of all things in the army. I recruited 10% of the army a year and was the only person, bar the people recruiting for the band, who actually had full recruitment. But that was just doing things differently.
And how many does the army recruit a year then?
Those days, about 7,000 a year.
So you personally recruited 700, or your bit?
Well, yeah, I was responsible for the recruitment of 700, yes.
Gosh. So you must be quite good at interviews then.
Not all were quite so difficult as some of the interviews I do nowadays. Yeah, so moved on from that. Yeah, I sold cattle plant machinery up and down the country, which is quite interesting because you're then pushing against the system, pushing against the machine, trying to get into large corporates to get them to move. I went to AIM-listed.com, so I've done that as well in the past. That was taking something very innovative and moving it into an AIM format and then making it regimented itself, sort of kind of stifled it a bit, but it was also fighting against all those larger corporates like BT, BT Ignite at the time, that was controlling the marketplace. But hugely innovative, fantastic environment to work in. I mean, we had the first product with fixed line, mobile and internet combined, all that sort of stuff. But it was a really innovative team, about 50 people. It grew to about 350 and then went to horribly wrong.
What was the sort of flaw in the system there then?
Well, we worked as an affinity organisation, so effectively we tried to be a middleman between the big service providers and the end user, but also put in an affinity proposition in there. So we had people like PowerGen. I don't know if you remember the days of PowerGen sponsoring the weather. They said gas, electricity, telephony. Well, we provided the telephony, but we also did tiny computers online, all that sort of stuff. But there just wasn't enough margin.
Right. I was thinking when it sounded like you're a bit of a broker, that being a broker is quite a tricky thing to be in the modern world, because you're being squeezed either by oligopolies or by technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were slightly more than a broker, to be fair. We had our own fixed line network.
Oh, right.
So we actually controlled the ISP. We were a virtual mobile operator. So it wasn't just that. We were actually controlling the technology and the implementation as well. But yes, I agree with you. Being a broker in today's world is fairly challenging.
Although, like most principals, one can find where brokers are necessary, and we'll come on to a bit later. You guys need shoe leather and checking carpet tiles and all that kind of stuff. And actually, thinking back to these slides, I do have a slide about being a shapeshifter in the presentation. And one of the things I can say is that shapeshifters don't exist, of course, but it's really important to be one. And it sounds like you've been a very effective shapeshifter.
Well, it's a really interesting analogy. I mean, I think I have previously described myself as someone who's able to adapt and talk to those people that are in the room and get on their level. And I think, if that's what shapeshifting is, yes, I probably plead guilty.
Yeah, so I think one of the things, I mean, must stop talking about my talk tomorrow, but one of the things I'm quite keen to get across, having just seen both my daughters now go through A-levels and all that kind of stuff, is how regimented and how systematised exams are. In the world of mark schemes and past papers which are publicly available,
There
is a right answer. You get marked well on the basis of how much you memorise and how well you regurgitate it in precisely the format they want. No shapeshifting at all.
No, and I think the shapeshifting will come whether people like it or not, because artificial intelligence will change significantly the type of jobs that are available for people to do. And unless you add value, you're not going to have a job.
Exactly. So coming to having a job, basically there's two main things that you can do these days. You can work for the state, as you did, I guess, indirectly via the military, or you can work for large corporations, and you've done that as well. And then there's this sort of smaller, crazier sector of where people go out and do their own thing as kind of free-range chickens, as it were. So when did you join the chickens?
Well, I've been in the chickens a little bit throughout my career, actually. I've gone up and down. I was in a small importing company, importing machinery into the printing and packaging industries. I then went into the AIM-listed.com, which is quite small as well, 50 people at the time. And now, I'm in a relatively small business. We've got 12, 13 FTE, full-time equivalent people here. And we've got a sister company over in the States with about five. I just decided I have enough of large corporate world and I'm not alone.
Yes, yes. Nor virtually everybody I've met in this world, myself included. So let's dive into the trade finance. And I gave a tiny, tiny thumbnail sketch at the beginning, which is that trade's been around for a while and finance has been around for a while and trade finance has been around for a while, and it sounds very straightforward, but it isn't. So going right back to basics for maybe many of my listeners, if not most of them, who have no direct experience themselves of trade finance, kind of what is trade finance, simply put, and how come it's sort of harder than you might imagine?
Well, it's a bit Ron Seal for a start. I mean, it is trade finance is the finance of trade.
Very good. I did ask for a simple definition. That'll do.
Trade is always difficult because, I mean, effectively, you are, in a lot of cases, moving goods from one location to another. And you also got to pay for those goods. So you've then got a dichotomy where one side would like payment in advance and the other side would like to wait as long as possible in terms of when to pay. So trade finance is about bridging that gap and getting to a position where both sides are happy. Obviously, if I am the buyer and I have a seller in China and they want payment up front, in a lot of cases, if I've got no relationship with them, I will have to pay them in advance before they give me the goods. Now, obviously, that increases my risk considerably because I don't know, A, if they're going to provide the goods, B, what quality or quantity the goods are, or C, if I'm doing the right thing. You know, I really don't know at all if I'm doing the right thing. You go to the other side, you are the seller, and the guy who's buying it says, hang on, I'm not going to pay you until I get control of the goods and until I've inspected the goods and had a look at them. Then, you know, that's increasing his risk or her risk because they are not going to get any money until you're happy with the goods and you've got them, always assuming you pay them. Because if you don't pay them, you've got control of the goods and you've got the money as well. So trade finance is all about bridging that risk between the two parties. And there are a number of different complicated ways that the banks have come up with to cover that risk. Obviously, costly as well.
Yes, and it sounds like the kind of thing, again, just keeping it sort of very simple in kind of cartoon-like pictures for the moment anyway, it sounds like the kind of thing which is quite risky. I think I was reading something over the weekend, actually, about, I think it was David Graeber, talking about the origins of capitalism and all this kind of stuff, and one of the origins was financing these expeditions from Spain and Portugal and the UK. People went off in ships and might come back with some stuff.
Oh, absolutely. You hope they're going to come back. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Where, and the timescale was sort of much longer than probably the timescales that you're dealing with, because in the past it took quite a long time to sail off and you'd be waiting quite some time to see what your return on investment was. But even in the simple case where I'm just buying some stuff from China or I'm trying to sort of flog some stuff to Cuba or something, isn't it a bit risky? You know, just a very high level, how do the providers of trade finance go around the fact that it all sounds risky?
Yeah, it is risky. And I think the historical way that it's being done and the way it's still done today by a lot of the large banks is that you get proof of every single stage of the process. So when your goods are put on board a ship, you get a bill of lading, you then get manifest and everything else that goes along. So you've got a list of what the goods are, description of where they're going, how they've gone, what stage they're at. And this is all basically a paperwork trail, if you like. And that paperwork trail has to compare with the paperwork trail at the other end. So effectively, you have a bundle of documents that come in and are checked against what they're expected to be, and if they are exactly the same, then in certain cases people will pay out money, simplistically.
Yes, so it's a very, we'll come on to the sort of digitalisation and these kind of things in a minute, so it's a very process-heavy, documentation-heavy system.
Absolutely, there are very thick manuals that you can kill a large number of flies with that describe absolutely all the steps, what the terms are, and there's a whole lot of description and terminology around this, as you can imagine. And you know, you get paid in various different places, various different times, and you have to tick various different boxes to do that. But it is hugely intensive, and the paperwork has to physically flow around the world from banks to banks.
Gosh. And again, just at the highest level, we're talking about trade and going through my thing about the factorisation of agriculture, manufacturing, and then service sectors. Just take the trade finance market in the UK, should we say, at the moment. So rather than first, I should have asked you this one before and you could actually look it up on Wikipedia. But if you had to guess, and we drew a pie chart of trade finance, for the sake of argument, what percentage of that would be agricultural, what percentage of that would be machinery, and what percentage of that would be just intangible services, or do intangible services not particularly get covered by this?
Well, services per se do not get covered really by trade finance. It's very difficult for them to do so. We can actually do that, and I'll come on to that later. But really, you have to have tangible goods. Because as well as there being a paperwork trail, all the banks require security. And the security that they utilise is the ownership of the goods.
Yes. So it's their goods.
They become their goods until...
It's a bit like having a mortgage. It's actually really their house, especially if things go wrong.
Yes, though I don't like to think that, and my wife definitely doesn't. But yes, I mean, fundamentally, they want something to rely on. They may well have other things to rely on, but they rely on the goods first and foremost. But, you know, I've heard of lots of trade finance houses that have got warehouses full of fake shirts that are going nowhere.
Yes, yes. I mean, and on the intangible, I remember Anil Stocker from Market Invoice talking about the fact that one of the things that Market Invoice were doing compared to traditional invoice discounting was much more in the direction of intangible stuff like, oh, I didn't know, well, you wouldn't commission me, but maybe I commission you to do a design and you send me the design and I say, don't really like it.
Yeah, it becomes very difficult if there's a dispute.
Yes, absolutely. Or even with physical objects such as milk. I'm a farmer, I've got 1,000 cows, I send 1,000 gallons of milk to Tesco's, and they say, wasn't good enough.
Yeah, there's always that risk, and that, particularly so in the receivable finance sector with Market Invoice and the like, so you can have it rejected. You then paid out the money, you've got to go back and sort it out. We work on quite a simplistic principle in that effectively we get an agreement between the two parties that they are undertaking a transaction, and we facilitate the payment of that transaction, not the transaction itself. So we are separate from the transaction. So the transaction takes place in the background, but we facilitate the payment of the transaction. So from our risk perspective, our risk is with the buyer. So the buyer has agreed to pay us in 120 days or whatever it happens to be, come what may. So they still have their risk associated with the transaction, but we only have a risk as Trade River onto that buyer.
It's a different model, isn't it? And I mean, you were talking about your platform, and your platform connects buyers and sellers, and anybody who's still thinking sort of alt-fi terms, likes of Zopa, for example, borrowers and lenders on the platform, it's not that kind of thing. It's, for the sake of argument, buyers and sellers of real stuff. Yeah, buyers and sellers of a million shirts. People in the real economy.
Yes, these are people
who do stuff.
Who do stuff, yeah. A lot of us who sit around it, but yes, these are people who actually make the world go round.
Yes, and I mean, obviously, and this applies to everything. As you say, there's all this paperwork that needs checking, and all sections of financial services have forever been checking paperwork in this particular way, and paperwork isn't always a guarantee. I remember I was somewhere once, I know even less about shipping finance than almost anything else, and some chap was talking about shipping finance and blah blah blah, and they were going through all this, and I think it was some risk seminar or something, and you know, it was all sounding fine, yes you would, wouldn't you, blah blah blah, and, you know, what could possibly go wrong? And then at the end he said, well, and one of the most harrowing episodes of my career, and he seemed to be late 60s kind of thing, was we did whatever it was, shipping finance or something, and this ship didn't exist. We had all the right documentation, but there weren't no ship, and that was very disappointing. And he's remembered it for many decades.
Receivable finance is a reasonable amount of fraud, you know, and trade finance is also an area that's around for potentially being fraudulent as well. Hopefully, I'd like to think we overcome that risk.
So, going on then, we are in the 21st century. Trade finance, as we say, has been going a long, long, long time. Roman Empire and before, no doubt. It's grown up with all these sort of various conventions around it. As you say, lots of paperwork. So, in principle, how hard can it be? In principle, this is, quotes, ripe for disruption, digitalisation, etc., etc. But in practice, things are never quite that simple. So what are the problems, as it were, that you're trying to solve, before you get onto how you and others are actually trying to solve them? So what are the problems of trade finance as it is at the moment for buyers and sellers?
Well, I think the problems of actually trade finance are that it's actually quite a complicated process if you're actually looking at all the individual component parts. And you're actually trying to ensure that everybody can have visibility of the whole process all the way through, and that everybody is happy that each of the component parts of the process have been ticked off and undertaken. Currently, that's done through paperwork, but obviously there are huge opportunities to do that electronically. Distributed ledgers and the likes are there and available to do that, so that's allowing that visibility and allowing people to know exactly what's happening at every stage.
So that's where it is, by and large, still. The likes of Trade River are busy trying to, quote, 21st centuryise it. Where on earth do you start?
Well, I like to think we start quite simplistically. I mean, I think if you look at a lot of the announcements that have come out from all the banks, and you know, they're doing this mass joined-up approach to digitising trade finance and making it easier, that's well and good, but that's going to take them quite a few years to implement and actually produce. We work on the principle that actually let's keep things simple. Let's help those people who are growing. Let's help those people who've got reasonably good relationships with their suppliers. And let's make it as easy as possible for them. And that's where we are. We make it easier for people to do trade finance. But also, we're looking slightly further afield and looking at those people doing supplier finance. Now, the difference between trade and supplier finance is, a supplier finance, I would look at it, is where the buyer actually doesn't need any money, if that makes sense. In a trade finance scenario, you are providing the money that the buyer would use to pay the seller on behalf of the buyer. In a supplier finance scenario, you are paying the money away to the supplier because the supplier has the need
to make the stuff now.
Yes, therefore the supplier hasn't got the money, hasn't got the credit, so you're actually putting the cost onto the supplier rather than onto the buyer. So effectively, if we look at it, you could have a large, I don't know, 50, 200 million pound business that's very credit worthy, that has a small SME, 5 million, who's wanting to ramp up production to supply the 200 million turnover business, but actually they haven't got enough money to do it. But don't worry, by doing it this way round, you can actually have the money potentially in advance, but definitely when you've provided the goods, which helps your working capital and enables you to provide the goods to the buyer that you couldn't otherwise do.
Okay, so I don't want to put words into your mouth, but this then makes me think about, in an ancient market, millennia old, which has for some time been sewn up by an oligopoly of trade finance specialists, particularly yep. in the large banks, and you guys come along and want to join at sort of the lunch table, you're trying to sort of squeeze in somewhere and stick your elbows yes. in and try and move your elbows out a little bit. Are you saying then that the approach to disruption, using a military thing, is a kind of beachhead, that you try and pick a weak spot and establish there?
No, not really.
Or a subsector?
I think actually the large banks have already moved. On trade finance, they've moved higher up, so they're very little coverage in the SME or low-end MME marketplace. I'd also say in the supplier finance marketplace, below 750 million turnover, they're not interested because they're doing complete whole turnkey solutions where you encompass your whole supply chain into these solutions.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so that's more a question of the fact that in a world that's going to oligopolies in sort of pretty much everything. I mean, you mentioned telecoms in the UK. Only know if I think about whether it was two or three of telecoms companies these days, or no more than five, even though I strain my brain. Banks as well are becoming sort of bigger and bigger and bigger. And so you've got the big ones serving the big ones. And actually even the medium ones are getting missed out now. So there's a need for firms who understand the market but have a lower cost base and are more efficient to then provide people who have been told, oh, sorry, you're no longer big enough for us.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if we lose clients, we lose clients through two real ways. One is we exit them because their situation changes and we no longer want to work with them, and potentially they no longer want to work with us, or our solution is suitable for them. And the other key way is when we grow them to a certain size that actually they then become attractive enough for the banks to come back into the market and take them back again.
Yes, well, I've seen this many times. This is where, of course, it isn't compete, it's cooperate, because you're helping the big players by taking the sort of six-year-olds and seven-year-olds and training them at rugby, and, you know, then the Bath Rugby Club will quite happily take them off your hands by the time they're 18.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I only have to look at the Lions tour. We had two guys who'd come from rugby club who were playing in the game, but you're absolutely right. And actually, we are non-competitive, really, with any other financial service, particularly the banks, because we don't require any security, so we're an unsecured provider. And effectively, we are balance sheet neutral, so there's no change to a company's balance sheet. So there is really no downside, if you like, to any other financial service provider working with us. And in some respects, there's an upside because we can do things that they couldn't do, and it avoids people looking elsewhere.
So just unpacking those two, if I can remember two things, there's the unsecured one. As we were saying before, in the simplistic terms, trade finance is risky, and by and large, people take some security to offset that. But you're kind of kind or crazy or clever, and you say, oh, don't worry about security, we'll lend you the money anyway. So how does that work out then?
Yeah, it's a very good question.
And isn't unsecured more risky than secured, quotes unquote?
Unsecured is always more risky than secured, absolutely. What we do, though, is to back up our lending, we take out trade credit insurance on our buyer. So all our buyers are trade credit insured. So we will do a credit assessment on the buyer ourselves. We'll come up with a decision on where we want the limit to be in terms of the amount of money we're going to lend them. We'll then internally agree that. We'll then take that forward to our trade credit insurer. Currently, we use Atradius. We have used AIG before. And we will go to them and we'll present a case and say, we would like a £500,000 limit on this company. Could you assess it and come up with an answer? And more often than not, they say yes.
I see. So you're passing the risk on to the insurer?
Yes, who in turn will sort it out and de-risk it for themselves as well.
Yes, then if that AIG, it probably sort of disappears into the ocean. And then on the balance sheet neutral phrase, are you using that in the context that you raise finance from, for the sake of argument, banks or the market, and then you're using this as the oil between the buyer and the seller?
No, sorry. I was meaning balance sheet neutral in terms of the balance sheet of the business we're lending to.
Oh, yes.
So they effectively replace a trade creditor with ourselves as a short-term creditor. So effectively there is, for all intents and purposes, no difference. Okay, there's a small difference in terms of our transactional charge, but it's notional.
I see. But in terms of you financing yourself, you guys aren't taking the money out of your own pocket. You're not doing a P2P. Oh, we've got 5 million credit this week. Let's put it on our platform and see who's going to come and give us money. You go out and raise money from providers yourselves.
Correct. We're not P2P. We actually borrow on the back of, the majority comes from large financial institution. At the moment, our largest provider is ABN AMRO. We have a receivable finance line with them, but we also have two additional lenders on top of that. And we have had a third recently as well.
Interesting. Well, I touched on the word broker before, which was the inaccurate word to talk about your AIM incarnation. And you're certainly not what I necessarily consider sort of quotes just a broker at the moment. But it is interesting in sort of the complex economy that we live in, when we've got these oligopolies, that there are, as it were, ecological niches where people can sort of sit down and actually provide value to a whole number of players. You know, if you had sort of inputs, outputs coming from here, let's just put it in Roman terms. If you had to have a road to everybody, you'd have a road to buyers, you'd have a road to sellers, you'd have a road to insurers, you'd have a road
Absolutely.
To wholesale finances. And somehow you're sitting in the middle, making everybody happy on a good day.
Lawyers as well.
Lawyers, road to lawyers. Everybody makes lawyers and accountants and even podcasters.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the number of spokes that come out of a lot of businesses is quite exceptional. And we've probably got more than most.
Yes, and one of the things I just noticed sort of by a very brief glance at your website this morning is going back to sort of grey hair and no hair. There are parts of finance, fintech or whatever, which can be disrupted from more sort of quotes, teenage plus perspective. And there are other markets which are sufficiently complex that by and large, you know, the average experience looks more like sort of 20 years than 2 years.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I mean, I think if you look at our credit department, they've all had 30 years plus in credit. And that'll be continually what we recruit as we grow and go forward. Similarly, our founders were no spring chickens when they founded it. They weren't the sort of 20-ish whippets. And I've had a little experience as well, so yes.
Okay, so that's interesting. And I like this dynamic and I like the idea of the spokes and the creativity. And I'd like to thank all the listeners out there, certainly one of the spokes, and today one of the spokes of Trade River. Everything's connected in this world. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, secured peer-to-peer business lending, connecting businesses requiring finance with investors seeking a secure and favourable return of up to 9% per annum. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS, from startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So we touched on rugby, and we've touched on trade finance, and we've touched on Trade River. But in terms of the millions of listeners out there, who no doubt will be tuning in with fascination to this one, who might be interesting for you guys and vice versa? I did suggest that you sort of say if you needed sex, drugs or rock and roll, but you said you didn't finance most of those things.
Sadly not. I mean, I think, you know, rock and roll, yes, the other two not. Really, for us as a business, what's really key is having partners and the correct partners and having contact with those people who come into contact themselves with innovative, growing, entrepreneurially run businesses, which are generally our target market. We want to help those people who want to help themselves and get going. And yeah, it's really important for us to be able to connect with businesses that are growing. There are an awful lot of businesses out there that sit in what I would call our universe. And that is businesses that we would give a credit limit to. However, they also have to have a need. And in order to reach those people that have got a need, we need to work with really those people in accountancy companies, those key partners who are the actual go-getters and the drivers, foreign exchange companies. We need to work with banks. We're very happy to work with banks because banks will frequently come across clients that they can't help that we can, and actually they'd want to maintain that position. So really,
all those sort of people who I would call channel partners who can work with us, you know, and obviously we have terms for working with people, where they can actually derive either an income stream from helping us or indeed provide benefit to the people they work with. And then we can help them grow. So the whole sort of one big, large mutual success story, if you like, all the spokes coming together and us enabling businesses to grow helps the country grow. So that's really how I view it. Is one of the key things for us is actually getting out and talking to those people who can help us and help their clients.
Okay, so that's very clear. So anybody like to partner with you can get in touch. And obviously we've talked in generalities because trade per se is, well, trade is the totality, isn't it? A totality of lots of different things. But are there any particular sort of archetypes of clients that you work with?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think one of the key things for us is that we actually work across a number of range of sectors and don't really have any particular sectors. That being said, manufacturing, apparel, to use the lovely American word.
Clothes.
Yes, absolutely, clothes. Media really is quite incredible. I mean, we actually, you know, pay for clicks on the internet. We pay for people's media spends, which, you know, other businesses in the financial services won't actually go out and finance. So the key thing to remember is we can do any sector, but we can also do anything. As long as it's not sex, drugs and armaments, we can finance anything. And that's be it services or goods within the UK, so UK to UK, or worldwide into the UK. We can do any of that. So real flexibility.
Excellent. Well, time's gone very fast, as it often does. And I think it's one of these episodes, one of these examples that often spring to my mind when sometimes one's talking to people outside of the city and FS and they think, oh, it's all finance, it's all bad, it's all just sort of greedy people making money and all this kind of thing, yardy, yardy, yardy. And I'm sure there is a bit of that in the city, always has been, always will be. But vice versa, finance is the oil in the engine.
Absolutely.
And you can't have trade, and the UK has always been a trading nation for a long, long, long time. You can't have trade without finance. So this is something which actually enables, quotes, real world activity, unquotes, in terms of, as you say, the exchange of goods and services. And it's always interesting and fascinating to see how businesses that have been around a long time with some very clever people in it are still being innovated and changed today, and how dynamic the digital world is and enabling innovators such as yourself and your colleagues to actually make things happen. So thank you very much for that, Guy. It's been very interesting.
Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. the firelight dance with me. Watch 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 the firelight.